Deepak Chopra, Wellness Radio, Sirius XM Stars, Sirius 102, and XM 155.
I'm Deepak Chopra, and this is Wellness Radio on the Sirius XM Stars channel, Sirius 102 and XM 155. You're listening to this program on these channels, but you can also find it on the internet, on your iPhone app, and anywhere in the world. And we repeat the program till Sunday morning, so you can, if you missed out bits of it, you can come back to it. On this program, we talk about spirituality, relationships, love, success, health and well-being, and always our favorite topic, consciousness. My special guests today are Elizabeth Thompson and Alan Savory. I'm going to start with my first guest, Elizabeth Thompson, tell you a little bit about her, and then you should expect some very exciting conversation here. Elizabeth Thompson is the Executive Director of the Buckminster Fuller Institute, and she has developed the Institute's leading educational programs, including its acclaimed website, high-profile public lectures, exhibitions and events, and the Design Science Lab. She has played an instrumental leadership role in the creation and implementation of BFI's flagship program, the Buckminster Fuller Challenge, and we'll tell you all about it. Prior to joining the Buckminster Fuller Institute, Elizabeth was the founding director of Planet Work. She served as director of John Gibson Gallery in New York and a founding member of the award-winning performance group Kukaraka Theatre, am I pronouncing it correctly, in New York. So welcome, first of all, to the show, Elizabeth. Thanks for coming.
Well, thank you so much for having us here.
Oh, well, for a little bit of conversation we had before the show started, I'm already super excited about our conversation. Tell our listeners, and they're all over the world right now listening to you, first of all, a little bit about Buckminster Fuller, because I think a lot of people may not know. They should, but they may not.
Right. Well, he was a 20th century visionary. He's best known, perhaps, as the inventor of the geodesic dome. He was really the sort of grandfather of environmental awareness, of an understanding and consciousness of the planet as a whole. He coined the term spaceship Earth to articulate that concept. He was
The spaceship is damaged right now.
That's right. He used to say that
distress.
That's right.
We should be sending signals all over the galaxy.
Absolutely, huh? Absolutely. You know, he used to say that we're all astronauts. Aboard spaceship Earth. He was really one of the first whole systems thinkers, people who really saw the Earth as a whole integrated system. He foresaw many of the challenges currently facing us, but importantly, he had a message of hope that we have the option to make it. We have the resources, the technology, the know-how to make the world work for 100% of humanity right now. It's not a pipe dream for the future. It's about changing our understanding, our awareness, our consciousness about what we can do right now. So
I'm paraphrasing here, but I think it's well known that one of Einstein's favorite sayings was, no problem can be solved at the level of consciousness at which the problem was created.
Exactly.
So, you know,
exactly.
We keep doing the same things over and over again, hoping to solve the problem.
That's right.
But unless we raise consciousness to a new level of creativity, where the problem actually has the solution contained in it.
That's right.
Then we're not going to be able to do it. And right now we have lots of challenges in the world.
Right.
Including what's happening with the climate, the devastation of the ecosystem. Oh my God, this oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
It's incredible.
It's like the earth is bleeding.
That's right.
You know,
it's a clarion call.
And I don't see the kind of anguish that this would evoke. Not just moral outrage, but a deep sorrow for what's happening. I mean, wants to make you cry. But we're so caught up with instant news and, you know, attention span is so little. But this actually, what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico with the oil spill. It's like we're bleeding so fast and the hemorrhage is not being controlled.
That's right.
And this, you know, things like this could destroy the planet in the very near future.
That's right. That's right.
And yet you're saying that we have solutions to all these problems.
We do. We and what we're trying to do at the Buckminster Fuller Institute is really point to people who understand that if you can change your understanding of the problem, mm-hmm. your awareness about your role as an individual mm-hmm. to take action, you and take a sort of whole systems approach to thinking about the world, the solutions are here, and it doesn't they don't depend on some huge technological breakthrough mm-hmm. that's needs to be developed in the future. They're here right now. Yeah. So
we are looking at a world which is at the moment plagued with environmental devastation, a world where 50% of its population lives on less than $2 a day.
Mm-hmm.
20% of it lives on less than $1 a day. So, you know, we have 50% of the world's population living in abysmal poverty. And at the same time, we show off about how you know, the world is getting economically richer because the GDP keeps increasing. Not that we're seeing the economic devastation also. We are living in a world with radical economic disparities, mm-hmm. social injustice, war, terrorism. And I think what the whole system approach might offer is that all these problems, they seem separate, but they're entangled. You
Absolutely.
Can't have peace if you have 50% people in abysmal poverty.
Absolutely.
And you can't talk about environmental reparation if there's conflict in the mm-hmm. world. So mm-hmm. they're kind of one problem, and the problem is limited awareness and not understanding the nature of consciousness.
That's right. And if you don't understand the nature of consciousness, then you're not going to think about a solution at the proper level. We're looking for solutions that are really getting at the root causes, at the systemic nature of the problem.
Right.
We're not looking at sort of band-aid solutions.
No.
They've got to be addressing multiple problems simultaneously,
right.
And looking at key leverage points. So
the Institute, the mm-hmm. Buckminster Fuller Institute, has something called the Buckminster Fuller Challenge. Tell us about that.
Well, this stems directly, obviously, from Bucky's, as Buckminster Fuller was commonly known, affectionately known, very much so, from his understanding that human beings have a very meaningful part in universe, that we're here to consciously participate in the planet's evolution, that humans are, from his perspective, humans were really seen as the universe's local problem solvers, and he called for a design revolution. So we launched this program in 2007. Each year we give away a $100,000 prize to a integrated solution that really is addressing one of humanity's.
How long has this been going on?
For 3 years. We've just completed our third cycle,
mm-hmm.
Had our conferring ceremony for our prize last week at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
We are the only large prize program that is really awarding an approach, a whole systems integrated approach to solving problems. And we receive about 250 to 300 entries each year, have a very distinguished jury that has the unenviable task of deciding a winner between very, very worthy projects. We're really interested in promoting and drawing attention to this approach to problems, solving problems to the degree that we can. So we publish most of the entries online in something called the Idea Index, which you can, so you can search by problem space and find.
How do we find this? We go to.
You can go to bfi.org and click on anything that's related to the Buckminster Fuller Challenge, and that will take you to all of this information.
bfi.org. Okay.
That's right. What we're really trying to do is change the way we conceive and implement solving these huge problems. Mm-hmm. It really is a consciousness shift. That we're.
So now on the phone we have the winner of the 2010 award, the Buckminster Fuller Institute Award, which is called the Buckminster Fuller Challenge Award, right?
Mm-hmm.
And his name is Alan.
Alan Savory.
Savory.
Mm-hmm.
Alan's online. Do you want to introduce him?
I'd be honored to. Alan Savory is from the Savory Institute and the African Center for Holistic Management. He is a biologist, a renowned systems thinker, and a pioneer in a process for decision making called holistic management. And we could not have been more thrilled to give the award to Alan this year as his prize-winning project called Operation Hope is a stunning example of what we're trying to promote in terms of solving problems. So welcome, Alan. It's wonderful to have you here.
Morning to you.
Good morning. Where are you calling from, Alan?
From Albuquerque.
Okay. So congratulations on winning this award.
Thank you very much.
And Elizabeth has been telling me about your work, but why don't you introduce it to our audience?
Well, yes, we actually submitted the project in Africa as a proof of concept showing the results on the land when we reverse desertification and heal the land and simultaneously people, economy, because what we've discovered over 50 years of working on this is that you can't actually manage land because it is so tied to the culture and the economy of the people living independent on that land, so we manage them together. And over many years of struggling with this thousands of year old problem of why mankind constantly damaged the land wherever we went, we found that there was a cause for it totally unsuspected, and that's what we deal with. So in this project we showed the results, because it would have been difficult to put the concept in, and the Buckminster Fuller judges are incredibly open-minded and astute, and they recognize the deeper concept. So we're extremely grateful for this award.
Well, you know, explain to us how this Operation Hope works. What exactly are you doing?
Well, in this particular case, we're dealing with a microcosm of the world's problems in Africa, where poor land leads to poor people, social breakdown, violence to women and children, increasing crime and so on, and it leads to increasing violence and genocide, and eventually the collapse of civilizations, and more than 20 civilizations have collapsed, and we've never been able to solve the problem of biodiversity loss that leads to desertification and ultimately to climate change. Well, fortunately, through the work we were doing, we found that what is causing it is the way that humans make decisions. You mentioned earlier that Einstein said we cannot solve the problems at the level of consciousness, or the words he used, I think, were with the thinking.
That's right.
The problems. We would just paraphrase that slightly differently and say with the same decision framework that caused the problems. Because what we've discovered is that all humans through all cultures and ages actually make decisions using one very simple underlying framework, and there were faults in that, and it wasn't our ignorance or stupidity or greed or livestock or the many, many things we blamed through the centuries. So in this particular project in Africa, we have changed the decision-making framework, and seen an amazing reversal of desertification and the underlying cause of so many of humanity's problems. The biggest issue we're facing in the world in many, many ways is just the incredible loss of soil, because ultimately all economies depend on the photosynthetic process for sustained wealth and sustaining communities. And the world figures, estimates are at the moment that we're losing 24 billion tons of soil down the rivers of the world for every year. That's 4 tons per person alive. And this is an extremely serious problem, because it's no good having a new green revolution, as Bill Gates and others, well-meaning people, are pushing for, because you can use technology to grow green plants. There are any number of technological means of growing more green plants with fertilizers or genetic engineering, but when you're doing it on disappearing soil, it holds no future for humanity.
I just want to remind our listeners that my special guests this morning are Elizabeth Thompson, the Executive Director of the Buckminster Fuller Institute, and Alan Savory, who won the award this year, 2010 award, the Buckminster Fuller Challenge. His project is called Operation Hope, and the goal is permanent water and food security for Africa's impoverished millions. And what we're looking at is a solution that addresses everything holistically, from mitigating climate change, biomass burning, drought, flood, drying of rivers and underground waters, disappearing wildlife, massive poverty, social breakdown, violence and genocide, all interdependently co-arising, according to Alan Savory, as a result of one wrong decision-making choice. So tell us about what is that one wrong decision?
Well, it's not one wrong decision. It's millions of decisions made all the time. But what we've found is that all conscious decisions by humans are made towards an objective. And then for half a million years or more, we've had the tool of technology, from simple sticks and stones, and then we sharpened them and chipped the stones and developed technology to where you and I can talk to each other on a phone and put a man on the moon. And then we had the tool of fire to manage our environment at large for nearly a million years. And then a few thousand years ago, people developed the idea of resting land or the environment to let it recover. So we try to manage our entire environment, including climate change, with technology, fire, or rest. And we always make our decisions on one or more of many factors: research results, past experience, cultural norms, fear, expediency, compromise, intuitively, and so on. Well, this framework is incredibly successful in the complicated arena of hard systems, what system science scientists called hard systems, hence our ability to explore space and have the weaponry and all the things we have today. But when we deal with economies and human relations and oceans and deserts and forests, I'm afraid we're just running into increasing trouble. Because in this framework, the making all decisions towards objectives, goals, missions and visions is linear, and the world is, as Bucky Fuller said, holistic in nature. And in these three tools that the world scientists are trying to address, desertification and climate change, there is no tool that can maintain biodiversity in two-thirds of the world. So we've made those couple of corrections and now see the results we're getting. And we call it Operation Hope because about 800 million people are living in incredible poverty in seasonal rainfall environments of the world, pastoralists and agro-pastoralists, and it's wonderful to see the hope that in their eyes as they realize that we can increase livestock, increase production, and produce flowing rivers again.
Okay, so, you know, we're going to take a short station break, and when we come back, I want to address two problems, one theoretical and then really get into what you're doing on a practical level. Thanks for being with me. I'm Deepak Chopra. We'll be right back.
Deepak Chopra Dialogues, Sirius XM Stars, Sirius 102, XM 155.
Welcome back. I'm Deepak Chopra. This is Wellness Radio on the Sirius XM Stars channel, Sirius 102 and XM 155. And my special guests this morning are the Executive Director of the Buckminster Fuller Institute, Elizabeth Thompson, and the winner of the 2010 Buckminster Fuller Challenge Award. The project is called Operation Hope, and it offers a permanent water and food security solution for Africa's impoverished millions. We were saying how everything is interconnected with the, you know, the drying of rivers and underground waters, disappearing wildlife, massive poverty, social breakdown, violence, genocide, all in kind of an interdependently co-arising manner. Actually, this is very Buddhist, you know,
right,
that the world is not linear cause-effect relationships, but everything interdependently co-arises from a level of consciousness.
Right.
And, you know, in the Buddhist framework, we wouldn't be using the word environment at all.
Mm-hmm.
You have a personal body, you have an extended body, universal body, and they're equally yours. So the atmosphere is your breath, and the rivers and waters are your circulation, and the earth is recycling as your body, and the trees are your lungs. So mm-hmm. why do you call it the environment?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Buddha would say, I have a personal body, I have a universal body, they're both equally mine, I can't survive without either.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I must love them both in the same way, and mm-hmm. not only love them, but have empathy and compassion mm-hmm. for the wounds of my universal body.
Mm-hmm.
So this very much in alignment mm-hmm. with that kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
What I want to get into right now, though, with Alan and yourself,
mm-hmm.
how is this program being executed?
Well, Alan, maybe you could talk about the what you're actually doing with the herding animals, sort of specifically how you understood that what has been perceived as the major problem in terms of the desertification is, in fact, its solution.
Yeah, the most condemned thing amongst many scientists and environmentalists is livestock, and this is not new. I believe you can go back in ancient Hebrew texts and see them writing about the nomads causing the desert. And there's no question that livestock are doing, I believe, far more damage in desertification, climate change, than even their strongest critics understand. But having said that, the only tool, and I stress only, and I stick my neck out as a scientist, the only tool available to us as scientists in the world to address mass biodiversity loss, desertification in the seasonal rainfall environments of the world that are mostly deserts, savannas, grasslands, is livestock. So in this particular project, that's what we did, was to prove this concept. And on land that was deteriorating very badly, with our river having gone dry all but for one permanent pool, we increased the livestock 400%, and we mimic nature by getting the livestock onto a planned grazing to get them the right place, the right time, the right reason, with the right behavior. And this mimics how animals would have behaved prior to domestication. And as a result of this, the land and the plants are exposed to the animals only for about 3 days, and then not re-exposed for 6 to 9 months or more. And we've had a dramatic increase in vegetation. In fact, we're battling to keep pace with the production now. We have hundreds of elephants and buffalo and sable and kudu and all the other animals of Africa. And we run these animals in a predator-friendly way. We bring them into a corral at night, or crawl, as we call it. And as a consequence now, we have the river running in most years. And what's amazed even us is that a mile above where we've ever known water in the past 100 years or so, we have open pools with water lilies and fish right through the dry season as we make the rain more effective with reversing desertification. And this has been done not in spite of 400% increase in livestock, but because of.
So the increase in livestock is one... increase in livestock is one part of the process, but I think the herding and the movement of the livestock is the second part, right?
Oh, it's the decision-making is the key to it, and in that you decide how you're going to herd, because people have had rotational grazing systems, mob grazing, all manner of grazing systems over more than 10,000 years, and no matter what they did, the land turned to desert.
So what was different? What was different?
Environments. So we had to find a way to deal with the full complexity, and we solved that way back in the 1960s. And what I did was just to, because no profession had dealt with this degree of complexity except military, I just took a military planning procedure and mimicked that, or imitated it, in the natural setting with wildlife and livestock.
Explain.
Can you talk, Alan, about the behavior of the herd when they are frightened, the hooving and the dunging, and what that does in terms of preparation of the degraded soil that when rainfall comes gets it on its way to coming back to life, as it were?
Yeah, the big issue is bare soil between plants. And there are only two things that cause millions of acres of land to have a high degree of bare soil between the plants. And those are too few large herbivores wandering around and overgrazing plants, and or fire. And both are standard practices worldwide. So what we do is to concentrate the animals so that these bare soil patches get trampled. As any gardener would know, that breaks and chips the surface, lets water in, air exchange, lets seed in, and then the hooves also compact the soil slightly, as a gardener needs to when you transplant a seedling. You need to compact the soil slightly, otherwise the seeds don't establish. And so the hooves do that. They lay mulch and litter, soil cover, and plants grow. And any gardener understands this immediately. So if you take a square meter of bare ground and you cover it with dung and urine and chip and break the surface, then when the rain comes, plants grow. And that's what we do. But we ensure that the animals keep moving to a carefully planned plan so that plants don't get overgrazed. Because a Frenchman discovered 50 years ago that overgrazing, which scientists believe is due to too many animals, is not. It has nothing to do with animal numbers. It has everything to do with the number of days the plants are exposed to the animals and how many days they get to recover from the grazing. Because the plants, the soil, the large herbivores, and their pack hunting predators all co-develop together. So we literally just mimic that now, and lo and behold, nature is terribly forgiving, and we see recovery.
So what I'm beginning to understand is that had humans not interfered, this would be the way the land would flourish, right? This is nature's ecosystem balancing itself.
Absolutely, Deepak. And this is the first clue I got when I was a young biologist in Africa in the 1950s, when I began to see that the healthiest land was areas that we were planning to set aside as national parks, where we had vast herds of buffalo and elephant and so on, and lions and wild dogs, and we had the healthiest land. And where most of the animals were removed and we had just a few livestock, we had more bare soils, silting rivers. And it just took years to unravel the problem and understand it.
It's very encouraging. I think hope is the right word because if this can be applied elsewhere, obviously it can, right? What about what's happening in the Brazilian rainforest, for example, where you know the land, the forest is disappearing at a very rapid pace and the decisions are being made purely on the basis of a very reductionist economic outlook, whereas what you're saying is this is going to revitalize the economy of Africa.
Well, this applies worldwide, and we've got it in practice in over 30 million acres in Canada, Australia, the United States, New Zealand, countries in Africa, and it's applicable anywhere. And yes, until we do this, we'll keep seeing really unwise actions like the clearing of tropical forests to put pasture in and cattle. We don't need them there. That's terribly destructive. It's economically unsound. It's socially unsound. It's environmentally unsound. But people make those decisions today because of the framework we use.
Yes.
The Brazilians used the holistic framework. They would quickly for themselves see that there are much more profitable ways of operating the livestock on the grasslands of Brazil. Mm-hmm. The grasslands of Brazil could run three times as many cattle without needing to clear forests.
Are you working with the governments in these countries?
Very few governments. This Buckminster Fuller acknowledgement is wonderful because for nearly 50 years we've gone through incredible rejection, abuse, ridicule, because people know that livestock are causing the desertification, and it was counterintuitive that we needed more livestock to correct it. So it's understandable, the ridicule and rejection, but I have worked with thousands of scientists in many countries, including a lot in universities, governments, etc., but institutionally, none of them support us.
Mm-hmm.
Individuals support.
Now, in the United States, the livestock that is basically there for the industrial food production, mm-hmm. like the beef, for example, that livestock is in fact a major cause of climate change, isn't it?
Yes, it's doing enormous damage. The factory running animals, mm-hmm. whether it be chickens, pigs, or livestock in a factory setting, is incredibly unwise. It's economically unsound. It's socially unsound. Environmentally, so it's doing great damage. So where we've got hundreds of thousands of cattle and so on in feedlots, we desperately need to get them out on the land because the desertification in the United States is frankly as bad as Africa. It's just that you don't have the high population on these desertifying lands. When you have dung and urine in concentration as in feedlots, it becomes an incredible liability and does damage to the environment and everything. Whereas when you have dung and urine on the land scattered and not in concentration, it becomes an asset.
So now, Elizabeth, with this award, there obviously gets a little bit of attention, but I don't think it's enough. How are we going to...
That's why we're here.
we're changing the conversation on the one hand, but there should be some real, like he said, he had a military approach to this. Could we have a military approach to this? Is so revolutionary that it could really bring back life on the planet.
That's right.
Alan is saying, you're seeing a lot more elephants. You know, I've been to the African savannah and I've traveled all over Africa. And it's just enthralling to see that life, the biodiversity.
Oh, we'd love to see you at our place.
Yes, I will come, but then let's think of a military global plan right now. How do we do this?
Deepak, what thrills me a lot is when my wife and I went for a book signing, when the second edition of our book came out, to both Canada and to Australia, in both countries, we were met by over 300 families practicing holistic management. And what thrilled me most wasn't so much the land results, but the number of people that came up to me and said, thank you. And I said, what for? And they said, you saved our family. It really saves families on the farms.
Right. But we need to, somehow we need to leverage this and scale it, as the word is,
exactly.
Right?
Yep.
If we don't scale it, you know, it'll be a waste of this enormous creativity that you have, which is really making a difference.
I think there is a big challenge to create a bridge between the work of inspired maverick like individuals like Alan and our other winners of the prize, and those in enormous seats of power who are who can change policy and do things, you know, at a massive scale. So, you know, what we're trying to do with this award program is to find those who are taking this kind of individual initiative with the depth of integrity that Alan has applied to his work for 50 years and shine as bright a light as we can on it and try to move it more into the mainstream.
I'm just interrupting to remind our listeners, you're listening to Deepak Chopra Wellness Radio on Sirius XM Stars, Sirius 102, XM 155, and that you can, if you miss part of this program, you can come back to it right through Sunday morning. And it's also on the internet and on your iPhone app if you have one. So we're discussing some very important topics here. As we continue this conversation, let me share with you something that we are doing at the Chopra Foundation and see if there is a possible synergy here. So we have a nonprofit foundation, and my work has always been about consciousness. So once a year, we have a conference called Scientists and Sages, where we bring together scientists who are exploring consciousness and then, you know, have discussions between them and sage thinkers. We've had some very interesting kind of scientists come there. At the moment, in conversation with the scientist Stuart Hameroff, who's co-authored with Sir Roger Penrose, who was the thesis advisor of Stephen Hawking, a new theory of consciousness where they say mathematically and based on some experiments that consciousness actually permeates the fabric of space-time at Planck scale geometry, that, you know, the whole universe is imbued with this consciousness.
That's right.
And that as we separate ourselves and forget our link with this, we do all the damaging things that happen.
Mm-hmm.
So we've also announced a $100,000 prize to be given once a year to the best scientific contribution on the understanding of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking maybe there could be some synergy between our two foundations where, you know, we have, in fact, I'd love to invite you to the next Scientists and Sages next year, and possibly if Alan will come to make a presentation.
Fantastic.
Because, you know, it's one thing to be theoretical and another to see what is the practical application. And this is a very practical thing. And, you know, you say that powers that control the world, you know, and there was so much hope in President Obama. But once he gets into the White House, then he gets surrounded with special interest groups, and they're very powerful. You know, you can't, he's had such a struggle going to Copenhagen and speaking there, or talking about nuclear weapons, or even healthcare reform, which is so ridiculous. But that's the reality. And I think the only way we can change this is to create a global collective conversation, not only using radio, but Twitter and Facebook and all the social networks, LinkedIn. You know, LinkedIn is now 65 million members.
That's right.
And I recently spoke to the CEO of LinkedIn and said, you know, with this kind of networking of social networks and professional networks, we need to change the conversation and harness the collective creativity of humanity to address these problems. And this is a perfect example. If people could get on board with the Alan Savory's creativity, you have a huge solution here, which is holistic, not in terms of just the, you know, restoring the land, but as he says, the rivers are flowing, the animals are back, and it's making a difference in the economy. And when you have that, you're more likely to have peace, and sustainability will go together.
That's right, and it doesn't require some new technological invention. It's right here. And I think that that is what was so stunning for our review team when we first came across Alan's work, and certainly for the jury, that people kept saying, well, wait a minute, you know, what is really
who's on your jury,
what is
by the
way? This year we have our jury comprises a very interdisciplinary group of you know, sort of leaders in sustainability, and we had this year Alan Kay, who's a pioneer in the computer science field, Jonathan Rose, who's here in New York City, who is a real pioneer in sustainable development. He founded the Garrison Institute upstate. Hillary Brown, who is New York City's, who developed New York City's sustainable building whole department. Jennifer Carrero, who is a young socially conscious activist using technology to do her work, a group called Taking It Global. Hardin Tibbs, who's a UK-based systems thinker, futurist. John Thackera, who's based in Amsterdam, who's a real pioneer in the design world. And over the years, we've had people like Bill McDonough, Sir Nicholas Grimshaw, Hazel Henderson.
Okay, I know
The Lovins, et cetera. So
you're listening to Deepak Chopra Wellness Radio, Sirius XM Stars, Sirius 102 and XM 155. Alan, let's give out your website and there's more information. And later today, I'd like to Twitter on this. You know, I have 215,000 people, but it goes up by 1,000 every day.
Fantastic.
So we can you know, seed the collective consciousness with these ideas. And you never know who's there.
That's right.
Who's responding,
that's
you know.
Right. Well, and so, I think it's... Oh, go ahead.
No. So why don't we get some information out? What's your website?
Deepak, our site is www and then Savory Institute, one word, .com.
Okay, let's spell Savory,
S-A-V-O-R-Y Institute, all one word, .com.
Okay, So savoryinstitute.com. I have information here in the studio. I'll be sure to be informing a lot of people repeatedly about this.
Thank you.
And there should be some way of getting. Have you caught the attention of President Obama or the administration?
No.
Well, we're trying. We are trying. Yeah, but would welcome any help you might have to lend.
What about, does Al Gore know about this work?
He knows about the challenge. Yeah. He was very influenced by Buckminster Fuller.
Yes, of course.
And we were hoping that he could join us in D.C. last week, but schedule conflicts prevented him from doing so. But we're also trying to get this in front of him, Alan's work specifically.
Mm-hmm. So. I think we need to do everything to get the attention of our president.
Absolutely.
After all, he has an African heritage.
That's
too.
Right. You know, that's right.
He owes it.
That's right.
To his ancestors.
That's right. That's a very good point.
Alan, what is your hope? If all your dreams came true, what would you see in the next 10 years?
Oh, it was just that we would get this holistic framework into the global consciousness because, you know, I've worked on the problem for 50 years, and please believe me, the whole future of humanity hangs on learning to make decisions holistically. We would be arrogant if we thought we were the only people in history to begin to see our connection with the environment, you know, in consciousness as we're talking. People in the past were far closer to the environment than we are today. But throughout history, wherever the footprints of man went, we deteriorated the environment. And so it's just vital we get this into the consciousness. In our textbook, to me, the most significant sentence is the one where I quoted a group of U.S. government officials and university faculty people training with us, who, after a week of training with a holistic framework, made the statement that they could now see that unsound resource management was universal in the United States. And frankly, it's no different in any country. And what was so powerful is that professional people, after just a week of training with the new framework, could assess their own work and make that statement. And I found the same when I was working in India, the same in Lesotho. It's the same every country.
India, of course, now, you know, all the wildlife is totally disappearing. There's hardly anything left. Except for one or two national parks. And even there, you know, man's footprint is destroying the ecosystem and very fast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Are you doing anything in India?
No, I did put on workshops at Bhubaneswar and in Tamil Nadu about 10 years ago. And in both cases, particularly in the Bhubaneswar one, I was training the Indian Forest Service. And then they looked at 12 of their policies they were practicing or planning, and they themselves assessed them very quickly after a bit of training, and they concluded all 12 policies would damage India and damage the forests and damage the communities. But institutions don't change. Mm-hmm. They just continue with the same policies.
Well, we've got to have a more holistic approach even in the change management. I think we can't do that through the institutions. Mm-hmm. We've got to have something else, and I'm sure we'll come up with it.
I think that's what's so important about this Alan's project in Africa, that it is a dramatic demonstration of this kind of
approach.
Where
in Africa is most of it happening?
Well, it's in Zimbabwe. That's where I'm from, Deepak. And
yes,
so
I thought so.
Yeah, so I had land there, and I was able to donate the land to the community, and that's where we could have it under our management. And the chiefs and I are the trustees, and we were able to demonstrate with our staff there. But we're working everywhere from the Cape to Ethiopia.
You mentioned a textbook. What is your book called?
It's called Holistic Management, and A New Framework for Decision Making.
Holistic Management, go ahead.
A New Framework for Decision Making.
And it's available right now in bookstores, online and so on?
Very difficult to find in bookstores. It's, I believe, been one of the best sellers the publishers have ever had, I'm told. But it's never been reviewed. All reputable journals wouldn't even review it.
Well, we'll certainly feature it on our website, deepakchopra.com. And my office will be in touch with you later to see how we can link it to some online bookstores as well. and we'll bring
Amazon have it.
So Amazon does have it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so we'll link it to the Amazon site.
Great.
And then, you know, later we should continue this conversation. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we can invite you, Alan, to speak at our Sages and Scientists as well. And Elizabeth, you too.
Fantastic.
For the work that you're doing.
Love to do that.
And, you know, this will be a nice confluence of, I think, only sages and scientists coming together can solve the problems of the world.
Right.
Because, you know, science as it is now is based on a wrong premise, which is the subject-object split.
That's
we just kind of look at the world outside the universe. You know, I was talking to a scientist the other day, and I said, how do you measure the universe from inside the universe? Aren't you part of the measurement? And they never think about that, you know, that they are, in fact, also a pattern of behavior of nature, and that that nature, and even the word is alienating, nature and nurture. It's all the same thing, you know.
Fuller called human beings pattern integrities.
That's lovely.
And I think what is so important about his particular genius and sage quality is that he was able to go from the highly spiritual, theoretical, right down into practice and demonstrate these principles, which Alan is doing, you know, which I think particularly now is so important for people to see concrete examples of how this kind of consciousness thinking approach can actually be manifest. And again, you know, that it's all of this is here right now. We don't have to keep looking and searching for the answers. They're
Alan,
right here.
May I ask you whether you use mathematical models, computer models, things like that?
Well, Deepak, earlier you mentioned we need practical solutions. I followed, I read all the philosophers and the theories I could, and Bucky's work and Smuts's work, who wrote Holism and Evolution, and gave me the operating principle in Darwin's Evolution of Holism. And really, I'm just a practical, simple man, and I decided we just have to come up with something that every person in every household can begin to make decisions that is socially, environmentally, and economically sound, short and long term, to what they want in their lives. And so I've really concentrated on the practical solutions and kept off theory. And so we haven't worked with mathematical models or any of that, but this doesn't jar with them. It just brings about a way for people to do what everybody's calling for. There's so many thinkers calling for us to be more holistic in our thinking. This is just a way to do it.
Well, you know, it's a way to do it, but I would love to see how it can be replicated easily by people across the world and, you know, scaled up even more than it is being at the moment. And that definitely requires, you know, some kind of replicability, you know, a model that people can follow, because not everyone is as creative as say Alan is, and yet that creativity now can be simulated by other people, hopefully.
That's right. And I think for your listeners, if they are interested in other examples of what we at the Institute call a kind of comprehensive anticipatory design science approach, on our website they can look at the work of the other five finalists for this year's challenge program. That website is, you can get to it from bfi.org. You can go directly to it at challenge.bfi.org. There's a really wonderful film that treats all six of the finalists' work, and there is something called the Idea Index, which has, I think, over 300 solutions to all different kinds of major challenges.
Well, you know, the Chopra Foundation has another initiative just started. It's called wellworld.org.
Okay.
And what it is trying to create global communities of well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment, we are looking at social well-being, community well-being, financial well-being, career well-being, and physical well-being. We're developing some material for spiritual well-being.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what you're doing, we should be talking about linking you on our website. So I'll connect you with our web people.
Great.
And we'll do this. I think it's time for the world to get rid of its institutional and personal egos and come together and harness this kind of collective Absolutely. Creativity, collective intentionality, and move forward. So, Alan, thank you so much for joining me. I'm sure to be in touch with you, and hopefully you can join our conference next year.
Oh, I will certainly join you. I'm honored to be invited, and thank you for...
And we would love to feature your book as well on our website. And, of course, talk about you on our wellworld.org site
Fantastic.
As well,
right.
including all the other work of the Buckminster Fuller Institute,
Great.
BFI.org. We have just a couple of minutes left. So, Elizabeth, anything more you want to talk about? Tell us about briefly about the other finalists.
Oh boy. Okay. They are, let's see, there's an urban core solution treating wastewater in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Chicagoans use 1 billion gallons of fresh water from the Lake Michigan every single day. This is a solution that recycles, reuses that water. There's an urban farming project that got started here in New York, in Brooklyn. Mm. There is, you probably are aware of the Barefoot College in
mm-hmm.
India.
Yes,
they were a finalist. They are training rural grandmothers mostly to become solar engineers and electrify their villages. There's a project called the Living Building Challenge, which puts forth an entirely new standard to measure performance of new buildings in our urban environments. And the last one is called Watergy. It's a very innovative greenhouse system that has application in our urban environments as well as arid regions of the world for using very small amounts of water to grow food. So that also is addressing all of the issues that are associated with food production, water scarcity, et cetera.
I have a feeling, will you be my friend? Can we be friends?
we have friends.
We have to talk
friends
about
in person and
ongoing
through Facebook.
Basis. Yeah. No, in person. And
yeah,
we
absolutely.
Want to also, you know, kind of promote your institute.
Fantastic.
And I think because the more people know about this, the more we'll be able to get everybody on board.
Absolutely.
So I'll take your
We so appreciate
emails.
The opportunity
no,
to share with your
privilege.
Listeners.
It's a pleasure. And I hope to have you back again so we can talk about some of the progress that's
Wonderful.
Being made, particularly with Operation Hope and Alan Savory's work.
Wonderful.
So thanks for coming, and we'll see you next week. Keep your feet on the ground, keep reaching for the stars, and keep coming back. I'm Deepak Chopra, and this is Wellness Radio.